This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Jennifer Koshinka in for Gordon Deal on this final weekend of 2017. Thanks for joining us. Here's what we have for you this hour. The federal deficit is soaring, and both Republicans and Democrats are responsible for ignoring it. You may not think winter is the best time to buy or sell a house, but it's quickly turning into one of the best times of the year to make a move. You love your pets, but would you go so far as to write Fido and Obit? And 2017 was a big year for hackers. What's ahead in 2018?
Cyber criminals have realized in 2017 that not only is cybercrime big business, it's going to finish at about $8 billion, but it's basically a risk-free crime because there are no international laws. So we're just going to see these attacks just increased tremendously. And from my perspective, it's going to be a scary, scary year.
That's Eric Cole of Secure Anchor Consulting. He'll be here in about 20 minutes with that story. Well, with the new tax plan in place, we're heading toward an enormous federal deficit. Republicans don't seem to care, but neither did Democrats when they were in power. Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal, has written a piece called Both Parties Are Deft at Ignoring Deficit, and joins us now. Jerry, what's the new tax cut plan going to do to the deficit?
Well, I think at least in the short term, it's going to increase the deficit. Republicans believe, or at least say they believe, that in the long run, it will create enough economic growth to pay for itself. There aren't very many economic models that actually suggest that's the case, and experience with tax cuts in 1981 and 2001 and 2003 cast some doubt on that. But I think everybody agrees that in the short run, at least, it's going to run up the deficit. And in fact, one group, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, estimates that by 2019, which is to say the year after the current fiscal year, it will push the annual deficit up above $1 trillion again, and it'll stay there for at least the next couple of years. So this is a hit on the deficit for people who worry about such things.
Jerry, certainly the Democrats are screaming about this, but what was the deficit like during President Obama's terms?
Well, if you look at the arc of the Obama presidency, 8 years, the deficit went above $1 trillion for the first 4 years of his two-term presidency. Now, that was largely because of a financial collapse that happened in 2008 just before he took office, and the resulting slow economic growth and the need to ramp up government programs to help bail out banks and pay for people who lost their jobs drove up federal spending. So there were certainly good reasons for the deficit to go up, but in the aggregate, it went from well below $1 trillion to $1 trillion and then back down. But it was rising again by the end of the Obama term. And overall, the increase in the accumulated national debt, which is all the deficit spending over all the years combined, went from $12 trillion to $19 trillion. So there was a big run-up in the debt during the Obama years when Republicans professed to be shocked at that sort of thing, and they're less shocked now.
We're speaking with Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. Jerry, what impact might this deficit have on programs such as Social Security and welfare?
Well, I think the big practical effect of this, there's actually two aspects to worry about. The higher the debt gets, the more the government has to pay interest on that debt to people who hold government bonds. And one of the problems, which gets very little attention, is that the amount of the federal budget overall that goes to simply paying interest on the accumulated debt keeps rising and eventually starts to crowd out government spending on other things that are either more needed by society or maybe better economic investments than simply paying interest. And so that's one thing. The second thing that I think people ought to be concerned about is that, you know, when the economy turns down and, you know, eventually economies even that are going up turn down again, there'll be less cushion there to increase government spending on things that are needed in a countercyclical environment to make up for or to try to help goose up a lagging economy. And so there's going to be less money for other programs and less flexibility when the time comes.
Jerry, do you think the average voter understands this, and do they care about deficits?
You know, I think they care, and I'm not sure they're entirely sure, you know, what to make of it at any point. But, I mean, you had a lot of Trump voters who kind of, for whom the Trump complaint that the debt had gone up under President Obama resonated. And the fact that it resonated for them then may create some problems for the Republicans and the Trump administration when it becomes clear that the deficit is going back up. Now, I'm not sure that they, in the end, make it the sole reason on which they cast votes. And in the end also, I think politicians calculate, maybe correctly, that while people complain about debts and deficit spending, they want the government programs that the government spending finances more than they want the deficit reduced. And so that's the tension, I think, in this question as a political matter.
And Jerry, in a year with midterm elections, do you think the parties will focus on this or do anything to correct the situation?
Oh, yeah, I think probably not, in to be blunt. I mean, I think there'll be some lip service about the deficit, and Democrats will try to use it to score some points. And Republicans will try to say that deficit spending means we need to go after entitlement programs, which are the big domestic expense that the government incurs every year, which is, say, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. But, you know, Democrats are going to have no interest in doing that because they'll essentially see it as cutting social programs to pay for a Republican tax cut. And in truth, Republicans aren't going to be all that interested in going after really popular programs in what will be a very hotly contested midterm election year. So I think you can expect people to bow to deficit concerns but not do much about them. That's the most likely outcome in the next year, at least.
Thanks, Jerry. Jerry Seib, Executive Washington Editor at The Wall Street Journal. It's 13 minutes after the hour. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. When it comes to the housing market, January is the new April. With inventories low, winter has suddenly become a hot time to buy or sell a home. Joining us now with some tips on how to navigate the market is Greg Yeager, real estate expert with USAA. Greg, what are some of the advantages of putting your house up for sale in winter?
For a seller, some of the advantages are that the buyers who are out there generally are serious. I think that somebody who really is out there looking to buy in the winter, you know, they've got some kind of serious motivation. It's a job transfer. It's, I don't know, a divorce. It could be a myriad of things, but things that make them serious buyers, which, you know, can be very effective from a seller's perspective.
And does the low inventory have something to do with what's going on right now?
The low inventory, yeah, you know, I think that one of the motivations for some folks to look in the winter is that, you know, the normal throngs of buyers that are out there during the traditional spring and summer months, you know, what they're finding is it's difficult for them to compete because every property that, you know, is high quality, that's priced right, seems like it's moving so quickly that people are disappointed. You know, they come in, they look at a home, and they want to make an offer, or they see it online on, you know, Zillow or one of the other MLS search sites, and they engage with an agent and say, let's go look at it, and they find out that it's already gone.
Greg, if you're planning to sell your house in the next few months, how should you prepare your home for winter?
There are the obvious considerations about, you know, winterization, you know, making sure that the furnace is inspected and working effectively so that, you know, somebody doesn't come through and find that to be inadequate or worse shortly after they buy it, you know, they find it breaking down. But, you know, roof considerations and so forth, making sure that, you know, because of the extra impact of precipitation and for the people, obviously, in your market that, you know, have snow and ice considerations, you know, making sure that the roof can withstand the winter. But, you know, I think that's the preparing the home consideration. But I'm a big proponent of using an agent. So when you talk about preparing a house to sell, you know, we think about those things in the space of curb appeal that applied during the summer months. Well, there's even more considerations about that during the winter months. There's less natural sunlight. So there are things that you can do with outside lighting, increasing the wattage in the bulbs and putting some potted plants that, you know, are that bring some color to the outside of the home on the porch or whatever. Variety of those things, a wreath on the door that increase curb appeal so that when somebody drives up, you know, they don't just see, you know, what appears to be the dead grass and trees and no leaves. I mean, that kind of thing that generally diminishes appeal. You know, you do things to increase appeal.
We're speaking with Greg Yeager, a real estate expert with USAA. Greg, what do you think will happen with interest rates over the near term?
It's been predicted for a number of years that, you know, we're going to see this gradual marching forward increase of rates, and we've seen some of that. You know, we definitely have seen some of that in the last 12 months. You know, but I think comparatively, rates are still at historic lows, you know, when you look at things over the long term. But any increase in rates does impact affordability. So, you know, I tend to believe that, you know, next year we're going to continue to see some rate increases, and that's going to, you know, put squeezes on what people can afford.
Well, certainly buying a house, selling a house is one of the biggest decisions you'll ever make, and it's also one of the most stressful decisions you'll make. What are some things you can do to make the whole process go more smoothly?
You know, it's interesting you bring up the stress, and I agree with you. And that, to me, is one of the beauties of wintertime buying and selling. The whole ecosystem around, you know, buying and selling, the agents, the mortgage brokers, the appraisers, the home inspectors, the title vendors, all of those folks, if you consider the demands that are placed upon them in spring and summer, you know, they're herding people through their ecosystem like cattle. You know, they don't have time to really take and spend the time with the consumer and work with them in ways, you know, imagine a first-time home buyer going through that experience in spring and summer. It can be very distressing. In the wintertime, I think that the ecosystem naturally lends itself to less stress during the winter, but also there's some price advantages.
Thanks, Greg. Greg Yeager, real estate expert with USAA. It's 22 minutes after the hour. Jennifer Koshinka in for Gordon Deal on this weekend. Well, 2017 was a big year for security breaches, and 2018 is expected to be even worse. Dr. Eric Cole, CEO of Secure Anchor Consulting and author of Online Danger, How to Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from the Evil Side of the Internet, is here now with some information on what to expect. Eric, should we be on high alert?
Yes, 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 and yes. Be on high alert. The way I describe it is 2017 was the warm-up. That was the cover band. That was nothing compared to what we're going to see in 2018. And the reason is this. Cyber criminals have realized in 2017 that not only is cybercrime big business, it's going to finish at about $8 billion, but it's basically a risk-free crime because there are no international laws. So we're just going to see these attacks just increase tremendously. And from my perspective, it's going to be a scary, scary year.
What are some of the primary targets going to be?
The primary targets are going to be you, me, and everyone listening. The media tends to focus on the big attacks, your Equifax and your other companies. So we tend to get this false sense of security that that's the main vector. Believe it or not, those are few and far between compared to the attacks that are going on against individuals. So it's you, me, our parents, our grandparents, our kids, and the number one vector is legitimate-looking emails with malicious attachments and malicious links. So if there's one skill that you can learn, it's don't trust email and be very careful before you open an attachment or click on a link.
What are hackers using this information for? Are they actually, you know, physically taking this information and doing bad things with it?
Yeah, it depends on the country, but most of the attacks that me and you and individuals have to worry about from the hackers are all financially driven. And a lot of them are coming from Russia, where what they're doing is they're doing identity theft to open up lines of credit in our name. They're doing credit card fraud. They're trying to do fraudulent wire transfers. Most of it is really, really financially driven to cause harm. And then when you bring companies into it and you start bringing in countries like China and North Korea, they're really focused on critical data and information. So any sensitive data, trade secrets, or anything your company has that can give a competitor an unfair advantage, that's going to be the other area they go after.
We're speaking with Eric Cole, CEO of Secure Anchor Consulting. Eric, can you mentioned the fact that there aren't international laws that are coming together on this. Can any of these attacks be stopped?
The damage can be controlled, but they really can't be stopped. And the problem is, to me, the U.S. government is approaching this a little wrong. We're trying to pass all these cyber laws. So the U.S. is trying to say this is illegal and that's illegal. And it's silly because none of these criminals are in the United States. So whether it's legal or not, they don't care. And they're coming from countries in which we don't have extradition treaties. To me, the focus of the government needs to be on regulation, on penalties and fines. This is what you have to do. And if you're not doing it, you can't do business in the United States, or there's going to be very, very big penalties. We have to make this very, very painful for companies that implement poor security. And currently today, like with the Equifax breach, in response to the Equifax breach, two things happened. Equifax got a slap on their hand, and the government gave them a big, juicy contract. To me, that's sending the wrong message, right, to how we should be handling this.
What can we do as individuals? You mentioned not clicking on those links that you don't know what they are. Is there anything else we can do?
Well, I always jokingly say my fundamental advice when it comes to cybercrime and the internet is drink and pray. And I'm assuming you're looking for something more detailed than that. The big ones is stay away from public wireless. If you're going to use public wireless, install a VPN, virtual private network. Be careful of attachments. And when you're on the internet, don't trust anything and be very, very careful of where you go and what you do.
That's Dr. Eric Cole, CEO of Secure Anchor Consulting. If you need more information, you can go to onlinedanger.com. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Give your employees the power to do their best work and maximize this year's budget when you update to new, powerfully performing Dell Business PCs with Intel Core processors. Dell's dedicated small business advisors mean you'll always get the best deal on the right solution for your business. Get up to 35% off select business PCs now until the end of December. Did I mention there's free shipping? Visit Dell.com/small business or call 877-BUY-DELL. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of it with us. Some of our top stories. The year got off to a rocky start for the Republican Party, but lawmakers finished it with a flurry. The outlook for the tech that will change our lives in 2018. Pet owners who are posting heartfelt obits for their animals online. And the weird things that people drop at midnight on New Year's Eve. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, 2017 started out as a rocky year for the president and GOP leaders, but it ended with a big win with the passage of the tax bill. Christina Peterson of the Wall Street Journal has written about the relationship between President Trump and Washington lawmakers this year and has more. Christina, have Republicans such as Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan put aside their concerns about the president?
Well, I definitely think that passage of the tax bill has eased a lot of tensions. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell just told reporters that he is warming up to the president's tweets, which is something he's had a lot of issues with. I do think that there is still some sense that he is going to be unpredictable and potentially not always as disciplined as he has been in the tax fight, where he largely stayed on the sidelines. So I think people are celebrating, Republicans are celebrating their tax win, but they are not convinced that it will carry over to next year.
Christina, are Republicans satisfied with the overall accomplishments of 2017?
I mean, I think that they would generally say it's been a bit of a hit and miss year. Up until this month, they didn't have a lot to show for it other than confirmation of Supreme Court Neil Gorsuch and some regulatory relief action. There was, of course, a very high-profile flop on the health care bill this year, but I do think that they feel that passage of the tax bill and at least keeping the government open through January was a better note to end on.
Christina, has the president changed the way he's approached negotiations with the other lawmakers in Washington?
I think the biggest contrast is his behavior during the health care bill compared to his behavior during the tax bill. And he was very involved in the health care bill. He made comments, often derogatory, about various drafts of the bill and various ideas that were being bantered about. In the tax bill, he really stepped back and let legislators do their work. And I think lawmakers really appreciated that they had a longer leash to just figure out what they could agree on. And that's really important, particularly in the Senate, where Republicans hold a very narrow 52-48 majority. And so there's really not a lot of room for error there. And they need to sort of make sure they have every Republican vote locked down so that they can proceed.
We're speaking with Christina Peterson of the Wall Street Journal. Christina, there won't be a whole lot of time to celebrate the tax win. There are many fights looming in January. What are some of the next big issues coming up?
That's absolutely right. January is going to be a mess. So they have to reach a two-year budget agreement before they can write a detailed spending bill for the rest of fiscal year 2018. Lawmakers hope to get that by the end of the year, but weren't able to. So they're going to try and hammer out what the overall spending level should be for the government for the next 2 years. That's a big fight because Democrats and Republicans have different ideas of whether defense and non-defense spending should be treated comparably. Then separately, there is a big fight over the so-called Dreamers. Those are the young people who are living here in the United States illegally now, but were brought here at a young age by their parents. And President Trump ended a program shielding them from deportation in September, but he gave Congress until March to figure out what to do with them. That is a very contentious issue on the Hill, and lawmakers are trying to reach an agreement next month to shield those young immigrants, but also add some beefing up of border security and interior enforcement measures.
On all of these major issues this year, there have been very little to none Democratic support for what's going on the other side. Will infrastructure finally be an issue that Trump can garner Democratic support for?
It's possible. It depends on how the funding is structured. It's not clear if that's really going to be a viable issue. Lots of lawmakers are saying they want to work on it, but it will depend on how they propose to fund these programs as to whether it gets Democratic support.
Are there concerns that there will be some negative pushback to the tax plan? People, as this went along and people found out more about it, the polls indicated that a lot of people weren't in favor of it.
Yeah, I think that Republicans are hopeful that people will become more enamored of the tax bill. Democrats are saying it's confirming what Americans think of Republicans as catering to big corporations and wealthier citizens. So that will be a big theme of the midterm push.
And do you think things will be kind of calmer overall because of the midterms coming up?
I think probably it will be a little bit quieter on the Hill, but things will be heating up in races around the country, so there'll be more sniping and more drama at the state level.
Thanks, Christina. Christina Peterson of the Wall Street Journal. It's 20 minutes before the hour. Jennifer Kishinka in for Gordon Deal. This portion of the show brought to you by the state of Michigan. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. What's ahead for technology next year? This morning's Gordon Deal takes a look.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group, and we're talking about the tech that might change our lives in 2018. When you kind of do these forward-looking things like this, what jumps out when you think of tech for the following year?
Well, so one of the first things that's popping out are these always-on PCs. These are new. These are laptops that run the Snapdragon ARM processor and have 20-something hours of battery life, up to 30 days of standby time, and are designed to always be connected to the internet via cellular connection, and supposed to cost around $800, but I think they're going to cause us to rethink whether we need tablets, because they kind of perform like a tablet and allow us to do things on our laptops that we currently can't do.
Why eliminate the need for laptops? Just because, well, we don't have to...
Well, for tablets, mostly.
I'm sorry.
Because they work kind of like a tablet. A lot of them are two-in-ones.
Okay.
They're fairly small for a laptop in the 12 to 13-inch screen range, and as I say, a number of them are in the two-in-one category, so they can be a tablet, they can be a laptop. I don't like the two-in-ones we had that were PCs, which had pretty much horrid battery life. We were talking about battery life in a 2 or 3 hour mode against an iPad that was typically 10 or 11 hours. These, as I say, have 20 hours of battery life, and then they're always connected. So you, no matter where you go, you're instantly online. You're able to browse and carry on. Well, I said battery place. Airplanes are still going to be issues, but as long as you're on the ground, you'll be connected as long as you've got a cell phone signal.
What about robots for consumers?
Yeah, that should be really big this year. Sony brought back the Aibo, a robotic pet, this year, and CES is supposed to be awash with robots next month. And a lot of them have grasping hands. I mean, a lot of the development's going on for robots that can be assistants. I think we're probably going to see trials for those, but we have a lot of ones that are kind of companions for kids hitting the market. I know in the San Jose airport, they've actually got a showcase for them. Now that you see as you walk through the airport, but fully articulated robots. So kind of taking the Amazon Echo and putting legs or wheels or whatever on it, and allowing it to move around the house and terrorize your pets.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle about things tech-wise that will change our lives in 2018. You and I talked about this recently, but where do you see voice assistants in the coming 12 months?
Well, they're getting screens. Amazon this month just launched a second one. I've got the Amazon Show now in two rooms of my house, but they just launched another one with a smaller screen that's more affordable. Hopefully, it will arrive here sometime today. But that's becoming much more common. So you can, as you're listening to the voice assistant, you can video conference out, talk to a friend or a relative about what it is you're doing. Put it in the kitchen, watch movies while you're working, and that kind of thing, or if you're browsing the web. You were able to use YouTube and watch YouTube videos about how to. Right now, Amazon and Google are having a little bit of a tiff, so YouTube's being blocked on at least Amazon's version of this thing, but that'll get fixed. But yeah, just they add a screen, and it adds a certain amount of capability. Plus, one of the handy things is if you really want to just annoy the heck out of the folks that are in your house, you can do karaoke on them. So rather than just listen to music, it will show the lyrics, and you can sing along mostly off-key and once again, and terrorize the pets.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle, founder of the Enderle Group, with Gordon Deal. It's 13 minutes before the hour. Gordon Deal with off, Jennifer Kishinka sitting in. Losing a pet is never easy. For some, it's such a terrible ordeal that they need to express their grief through an obit. Claire Ansbury has written an article in the Wall Street Journal about this new obit trend and joins us now. Claire, were pet obits ever placed in newspapers?
They were, but it had to be a famous pet or a pet belonging to a famous person. There was one back in 1931 when a dog named Igloo died, and he was the pet of Admiral Byrd, who went to the North Pole, and Igloo accompanied him. So Igloo merited an obit in the newspaper, and, you know, every once in a while there would have been an obit of a long-living, you know, like an 83-year-old bird at a zoo that, you know, everybody in the community knew. And then there have also been some celebrities who have posted obits about their pet. I think it was Sarah Silverman posted about the death of her dog. So if it was a famous dog or a dog belonging to a famous person or any sort of pet, then they might get a mention in the newspaper obit, but not very much.
What if a regular person, you or me, wanted to put something in a newspaper?
You might have a hard time doing that. Some newspapers, but not very many, might let you have a little mention in the classified if you want to pay for it. But newspapers in the past who have done this there's a lot of backlash from their readers. They don't want the picture of a dog next to their mother who died. There was in an Iowa town that happened. A dog named Bear died, and it ran the sister-in-law of a woman who also passed and whose obit was right next to the dog's was furious, and she wrote a letter demanding an apology for not only her family but every family who had an obit on that page. And so they're political. I mean, they can, you know, it really gets down to, you know, what do you define as a family? You know, obits now may include a pet as a survivor, but that's not even really commonplace either. There's just a sense of obituaries are for humans and people, and pets are still largely classified as properties. So some people say they should belong in the classifieds.
We're speaking with Claire Ansbury, The Wall Street Journal. So, Claire, this has all opened up a new frontier online, correct?
Right, right. I mean, you know, people post so much on Facebook that, you know, if a pet is near and dear to them, and, you know, some people have had pets for 20 years, their whole childhood. And so if they're grieving, they want to let family and friends know. And, you know, Facebook is kind of a protected, in a way, circle that you know you're going to get sympathy. You know, you probably can't call into work, call off work because your dog died. You won't get much sympathy there.
That is Claire Ansbury of the Wall Street Journal. As much as I love pets, I have not yet written an obit for one of mine. Well, millions of people will be starting 2018 Sunday night by staring with great anticipation at the big glowing ball that drops in New York City's Times Square. But did you know that many other items get dropped at midnight across the country? In Memphis, they drop a guitar. You can rock the December 31st Eve away at the Hard Rock Cafe, where they'll celebrate their 10th annual New Year's Eve guitar drop. A 10-foot guitar will descend at midnight. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, a 400-pound peep chick will drop. The show is part of the annual Peeps Fest, hosted by Just Born Quality Confections, maker of course, the Peeps. In Brasstown, North Carolina, they drop a possum. For years, convenience store Clay's Corner has lowered a live possum to ring in the new year. While the convenience store has since retired and closed up shop, the possum drop is still planned. Now, if that sounds controversial, that's because it is. In the past, Clay's Corner faced questions about the morality and legality of using a live animal. The peach drop will occur at the 120-year-old Flatiron Building in downtown Atlanta. Since 1989, an 800-pound peach has been lowered to ring in the new year. Happy New Year. I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to The Weekend, America's First News.